Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from The Voice of America. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear stories from Anna Mateo and Steve Ember. But first, this report.
For some time now, critics of higher education in the United States have claimed that many U.S. colleges and universities are centers of liberal thinking. Politically conservative observers argue that the information college professors present to students is unbalanced in its representation of the world. Some conservatives argue that this represents an effort by liberal educators to push young people towards supporting their beliefs. However, a new study suggests that professors are not the problem when it comes to influencing the political beliefs of college students. It shows that school administration officials often are, in fact, the more liberal members of the higher education community. The study was a project of Samuel J. Abrams, a professor of politics at Sarah Lawrence College in Bronxville, New York. Abrams, who identifies himself as politically conservative, reported his findings in October. Abrams worked on the study with the researchers at the National Opinion Research Center at the University of Chicago. Together, they asked 900 school administration officials from across the country about their political beliefs. Some of these officials work at colleges or universities that receive public money. The others are with private schools. The researchers chose to question school administrators who deal directly with students and their day-to-day activities on campus. The study found that about 71% of those questioned identified themselves as either liberal or very liberal. Just 6% said they were conservative. In 2014, Abrams led a similar study which found that half as many professors self-identified as liberal as did school administrators.
Abrams argues that U.S. higher education must permit acceptance of all kinds of beliefs and ways of thinking. Otherwise, colleges and universities will no longer be places that welcome meaningful debate, exploration of ideas, and the search for answers to the world's problems. Some professors may have strong political beliefs, he says, but almost all of them are trained to present different sides of issues in a balanced way and let students form their own opinions. That is not the case for school administration employees, says Abrams. And in the end, administrators dealing with student life have a big influence on students and their experiences in higher education. Abrams notes that the officials he spoke to for his latest study are mainly involved in shaping the student experience. They help new students find a sense of community with others on their campus. They create programs to help students celebrate cultural traditions, become active in social causes, and inform them about how to stay healthy, for example. But the problem is, this programming far too often only relates to liberal causes or ways of thinking, Abrams says. He is critical about open discussions of sexuality or representations of the free market economic system as being evil. Students are left feeling unwelcome if they hold conservative opinions on such issues, he says.
Kevin Kruger is president of NASPA, Student Affairs Administrators in Higher Education, which represents thousands of school administrators. He argues that Abrams' research misrepresents the relationship between students and school officials. Kruger notes that it is part of an administrator's job to make all students feel welcome. Also, most of the events on any given college or university campus are student-led. Money from students and their families pays for such programs, and student-led groups are the ones organizing them. So, for the most part, it is the students themselves who are in control of deciding what programming takes place. I think we're underselling the intellectual rigor of our students to think that we can indoctrinate them during college, Kruger said. I think it sells short the actual ability of our own students to engage in dialogue and make their own mind up on the basis of facts. Kruger argues that there is no active effort to make campuses more liberal. If anything, the reason there are more liberal administrators is because schools are trying to make their campuses more diverse. In doing so, they want to employ officials who have experience dealing with and supporting underrepresented populations. And support for groups like transgender students, for example, is usually linked to liberal political beliefs, he says.
Rick Hess is the Director of Education Policy Studies at the American Enterprise Institute, a conservative policy and research group. Hess agrees that student diversity is very important, but he suggests school officials cannot only support diversity in terms of gender or race. In October, a separate study of 800 U.S. college students found that 54% reported feeling afraid to express their opinions when they disagreed with other students. Hess links these concerns not just to the majority of programs for students. He notes that some schools have permitted students to demonstrate against and even silence conservative speakers who visit their campuses. As a result, students who disagree with the values expressed at a given event feel silenced in much the same way. Hess and Abrams agree that colleges and universities must employ officials who have experience supporting different beliefs and finding common ground. Otherwise, students may fail to develop the ability to see the value in opinions other than their own. In addition, conservatives will become less interested in giving financial support to higher education. And both of these things, they warn, will be harmful to the nation as a whole in the future. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.
Now, the VOA Learning English Program, Words and Their Stories. On this program, we explore words and expressions in American English. Today, we take another trip to the exciting world of live theater. For many performers, dancers, singers, and actors, appearing on Broadway is a dream come true. Broadway is one of New York City's first roads and longest. It is also one of the most famous. Broadway's theater district is between 42nd and 53rd Streets in downtown Manhattan. This part of Broadway is the heart of American theater. To make it on Broadway, you have to be very good, but you also have to be tough. Performing in general comes with a lot of rejection. Even if you are hardworking and gifted, you may also need something else to succeed on Broadway. Luck. Maybe that is why theater people are so superstitious. They have customs or behaviors that many non-theater people may find strange. Take, for example, the expression, to break a leg. This may sound violent, but it is not. We often say this to wish people good luck. In the theater, you should never wish an actor good luck. That is considered to be unlucky. Instead, you should say to them, break a leg. But why? It hardly seems like a nice thing to wish on anyone. Well, there are several explanations. One comes from the wings, or the side areas, of a stage in a theater. In the wings, you will find what is called a leg line. If an actor passes this line, people in the audience are able to see them. So this line helps an actor waiting in the wings stay hidden from the audience before going on stage. However, it was a good thing, and even lucky, to cross or break the leg line. This meant they were supposed to be on stage and performing. So an actor who broke the leg line would get paid. Another explanation comes from the superstitious nature of theater people. To keep bad luck out of a performance, they may try to trick the gods, or universe, or whatever. They do this by saying something bad. In this case, break a leg. We may not know exactly how this wish of good luck got started, but we do know that it is much better to tell an actor to break a leg instead of good luck. It may come from the theater, but you can say it to anyone who needs a little luck.
Come on along and listen to the lullaby of Broadway, the hip hooray and ballyhoo, the lullaby of Broadway.
And that's the end of this Words and Their Stories. I'm Anna Mateo.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. We continue the story of Alexander Hamilton. He was the nation's first Secretary of the Treasury. Alexander Hamilton firmly believed that no country could become a modern nation without industry. So he carefully developed a program that would make the United States an industrial nation. Part of his program protected American manufacturers from foreign competition. Hamilton protected them by establishing a system of import taxes on some foreign goods brought into American ports. These tariffs raised the prices of those goods. As a result, American manufacturers had much less competition in selling their products. Alexander Hamilton also organized the nation's finances. One of his first steps was to pay back the debt the country owed from the Revolutionary War. But Hamilton wanted to go much further. He wanted to establish a national bank. Hamilton argued that many European countries had national banks. University of Virginia history professor Andrew O'Shaughnessy says Hamilton saw the advantage of Britain's system. It permitted a very small country to go deeply into debt while fighting wars. Hamilton said a national bank in America would increase the flow of money throughout the country. It would help the national government negotiate loans and collect taxes. Business historian John Steele Gordon says Hamilton believed a centralized bank would also keep the states from competing with each other. But Hamilton's plan raised old fears, especially among farmers in the South. Critics argued that a national bank would give too much power to a few rich men in the North. It would take control of state banks on which Southern farmers and small businessmen depended. It would also increase the use of paper money instead of gold and silver. James Madison led the opposition against Hamilton's plan in Congress. Madison said the United States should not put all its wealth in one place. So he proposed a system of many smaller banks in different parts of the country. He also argued that the idea of a central bank was unconstitutional. No one knew more about the American Constitution than James Madison. He was given credit for most of the ideas in it. Everyone respected his explanations of its wording. Madison noted that the Constitution gave Congress a number of powers which were stated. For example, the Constitution gave Congress the power to borrow money. But Congress could borrow money only to repay debts, to defend the country, and to provide for the general good of the people. Madison said permitting Congress to do more than what was in the Constitution was dangerous. Hamilton presented a very different view. His view came to be known as the implied powers doctrine. In other words, the Constitution includes powers without naming them. Business historian John Steele Gordon says this means that Congress can do whatever it needs to do to fulfill its duties unless the Constitution forbids it. In 1790, Hamilton's view won more congressional support. He got enough votes to approve his proposal to establish a national bank. Still, President George Washington had to sign the bill into law. Washington worried about the possibility that the bill was not constitutional. So he asked three men for advice: Attorney General Edmund Randolph, Secretary of State Thomas Jefferson, and Treasury Secretary Alexander Hamilton. Randolph had no firm answer. Jefferson agreed with Madison. Creating a national bank violated the Constitution. Hamilton, of course, disagreed. He said the Constitution gave government a number of powers besides those written down. Otherwise, he said, the government could not work. These arguments did not completely answer all of President Washington's questions, but he went ahead and signed the bill to establish a national bank in America. One of its jobs was to maintain the value of the country's currency and to borrow money for the government. The National Bank also increased the flow of capital needed for investment. It fed the country's business and commercial activities, and it collected taxes. Business historian John Steele Gordon says America's financial success in the 1790s showed that Hamilton's plan worked. The National Bank and many of Hamilton's other ideas had another important effect. They created a disagreement that still exists. The disagreement began with Alexander Hamilton and Thomas Jefferson. The two men were very different. Alexander Hamilton was born in the West Indies to a man and a woman who were not married. However, Hamilton was educated in America, and he gained a place in society by marrying the daughter of a wealthy landowner in New York State. Money and position were important to Hamilton. He believed men of money and position should govern the nation. Thomas Jefferson could have been what Alexander Hamilton wanted to be. Through his mother, he was distantly related to British noblemen, and he liked fine food, wine, books, and music. But Jefferson had great respect for simple farmers and for the men who opened America's western lands to settlement. He believed they, too, had a right to govern the nation. University of Virginia historian Andrew O'Shaughnessy says both Hamilton and Jefferson believed they were defending the ideals of the American Revolution. And, he says, their disagreement revealed their fears. Professor O'Shaughnessy says Hamilton remembered the chaos under the country's first weak government. He was afraid the government would collapse and there would be social anarchy. On the other hand, he says, Jefferson and his supporters were afraid that the American Revolution would, like most revolutions, fail. A small elite group would control the country again. In other words, they were afraid of tyranny. Hamilton and Jefferson's personal disagreements turned into a public dispute when they served in President Washington's cabinet. The president tried to make peace between them. He liked them and respected them. He believed the new nation needed the skills of both men. However, the disagreement became more than just a question of two strong men who could not agree. It became a battle of two completely different philosophies of government. Those who supported Hamilton became known as the Federalist Party. The Federalists supported a strong national government with a powerful president and courts. In the early 1790s, the Federalists controlled the Congress. They also had great influence over President Washington. Most Federalists lived in the cities of the Northeast. They were the nation's bankers and big businessmen. They were lawyers, doctors, and clergymen. But at the time, the majority of Americans were farmers, laborers, and small businessmen. Many were bitter over government policies that always seemed to help the wealthy. They had no political party to speak for them. These were the people Thomas Jefferson wanted to reach. Jefferson's task was big. Many of these Americans knew little of what was happening outside their local area. Many were not permitted to vote because they did not own property. Jefferson looked at the situation in each state. Almost everywhere, he found local political groups fighting against state laws that helped the rich. These local groups were what Jefferson needed. He worked to bring them together into a national party to oppose the Federalists. The party came to be called the Jeffersonian Republicans, or just the Republicans. It may sound confusing, but today many of Jefferson's ideas are expressed by the Democratic Party rather than the Republican Party. This is because of changes in parties and party names over the years. In Jefferson and Hamilton's time, says Professor O'Shaughnessy, the idea of organized political parties was new in America. At that time, he says, the people who fought in the American Revolution expected to be united. As a result, the country did not have any laws governing what political parties could or could not do. There were no restrictions on the political activities of government officials. So Hamilton and Jefferson carried on a war of words in their party newspapers. Jefferson especially felt the need for newspapers in a democracy. He believed they provided the only way for a large population to know the truth. He once said, if he had to choose between a government without newspapers or newspapers without a government, he would choose newspapers without a government. Both parties' newspapers carried unsigned articles attacking the opposition. Both printed stories that were false. At times, the attacks were personal. Many people felt the two cabinet secretaries should be above that kind of public fighting. But Professor O'Shaughnessy says that did not stop them.
The party politics became as bad as at any time in history.
Toward the end of President Washington's first administration, he received a letter from Jefferson. The Secretary of State said he planned to resign. He said he disagreed with most of the administration's domestic and foreign policies. He did not name Hamilton. It was not necessary. Washington knew what he meant. Hamilton was the chief planner of those policies. But Jefferson decided not to resign. In a letter to his daughter, Jefferson said the attacks on him changed a decision which he did not think could possibly be changed. He must remain and fight. So while continuing to serve as Secretary of State, Jefferson began working to get his supporters elected to Congress. He believed that was the only way to fight Hamilton. National elections were set for 1792.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.